maybe you just introduce yourself and I'll see how this works.
Okay. Hello, my name is James Blanchard. I am a commercial shrimp fisherman from Louisiana.
That's perfect. And today is July 20th, is that right? 2010?
2010.
This is gonna last forever, so we gotta get the... So don't worry about talking into the mic, it'll get...
Yeah.
So we're sitting in HOMA, and maybe you can tell me, did you grow up here? Is this where your family's from?
Originally, we're from Chauvin, which is probably about 20 miles further south, which we call down the bayou. Mm-hmm. And I grew up there, and I moved to HOMA in 1993. We were tired of the hurricanes and the floods and so much mud, and we just wanted to come around where it was a little drier.
So I'm going to ask you about that a whole bunch in a little bit, but is your family been in Chauvin for a long time?
Yes. The whole, both my parents were born and raised there, and I'm assuming their parents also.
Now, what kind of work did they do?
My father was a mail carrier for the Postal Service, and he did shrimping on the side with a small boat. And actually, he lost one arm right here, one hand, in World War II. He enlisted when he was, he lied about his age. He was just made 17, and him and five, six buddies took off to New Orleans and enlisted. Lied about their age.
Do you know where he went, where he served?
Yes, he served, he fought in the Battle of Guadalcanal, which was one of the major battles, Tawawa. That was three other major battles, not Iwo Jima. I thought he was at Iwo Jima.
But he was in the Pacific.
He was in the Pacific, South Pacific, and he did fight at the Battle of Guadalcanal, which was one of the major battles. And he never did like talking about the war. And I'd ask him questions. You know, I remember I was young, like 15, 16 years old. And he wouldn't like talking about it, but he found a book and he gave it to me. And one day he just out of the blue, my dad, and he didn't talk a whole lot. You know, he was kind of quiet. And he said, read this. He said, you want to know? He said, I'll answer you a lot of questions. And it changed my perspective at that age, you know, at 15, 16 years old. So
what did it change?
It made me really realize what he had went through, you know? And it was, I mean, I was trying to picture myself in situations like that. Even today, you know, I read stuff about, or you watch it on TV, and it's just, you know, it just tells you how brave those men were back then.
Really?
You know?
Hey, both my grandfather served also.
Yeah.
A lot of respect.
Yeah, it does.
Now, did you go out on his boat?
I did when I was young. We would get out of school early, and because, you know, like the school year ends in the end of May, and then the brown shrimping season starts at usually the beginning of May, mid to beginning of May. So several times I remember I would take my tests early, and we'd get out of school early, and then I'd go shrimping with them. And I was just, you know, a young boy, 12, 13, 14 years old. And I could remember I loved it. I just loved it. And it was a small boat, and I didn't really know a whole lot about it. And then just watching my dad do this with one hand, it just blew my mind away.
Do you remember
that he was able to do the things that it took? Because it was just him, my mom, and I, and sometimes one of my brothers.
Your mom would go out in the boat also?
My mom would come with us, yeah.
Did they always go out together, the two of them?
For the most part, yeah. Very seldom they didn't go together. Mm-hmm. And it was both of those, and then me or one of my other brothers or a couple of us.
How many brothers do you have?
I have five brothers and four sisters. So we have a fairly large family.
Yes, you do.
Yes.
Now, do you have any specific memories of being out in the boat?
I do. I remember one day heading out, my next oldest brother, he was supposed to come with us, and he knew a lot more about what was going on, and he was a little older than I, and he could do a lot more of the physical work. And for some reason, he couldn't come. So my dad said, come on, James, we're going to go, just me, you, and your mom. And I can remember heading out to the Gulf, to the lakes. We would fish in the lakes, not in the Gulf. And I can remember thinking that this is what I want to do for a living. And I probably at that time, I would imagine I was probably 13 or 14 years old. And
do Do you know what it was that made you know at 13 that this is what you wanted to do?
I think it was the peacefulness out there, the serenity. You know, it's quiet. You're away from the hustle and bustle. And just imagine back then, it's nothing like what it is today. Mm-hmm. You know, and then.
How so? What's the big difference you mean?
I mean, it's back then, you know, it wasn't as populated. You didn't have cell phones. And it was just away from everything. Just being out there in nature that I really, those things just really drew me to it.
Would your father just go out for the day or would he go out for?
Most of the time it was one to 2 days, mm-hmm. You know. Sometimes we'd go out in the morning and come back in the afternoon. Sometimes we'd stay a night or two nights.
But yeah. Summer she spent on the shrimp boat growing up.
For the most part, yeah. Not all summer, you know, but from time to time, yeah. And like I say, he would do it on the side. So he went out, you know, to go and make a whole lot of money, catch a whole lot of shrimp. It was just something that he enjoyed doing. And it was a side income.
So he would sell his shrimp, though?
Yes, yes.
Did you eat a lot of it at home, too?
Yes, we did. Yes.
Do you have any sense of when you were growing up, how much of your... When was that a big part of what you ate? Or you know?
No, not really.
Okay.
No.
Your mom's still going to the grocery store?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, I remember they would go, and like I said, we had a large family, mm-hmm. And he raised some cattle, not a lot, but a little, you know, to butcher and have meat in the freezer. And I remember on the certain times when it was time to butcher, it was a big deal. You know, I mean, we wouldn't do it ourselves. Mm-hmm. He'd had a butcher come, and they would take him away, and then they would do everything, and then it would come back in boxes all wrapped up, ready to go. And, you know, besides then we had seafood and, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you grew up pretty connected to the land then?
Yes. Yes, we did. And also my dad had, at one time he had over 300 satsuma trees. And the thing I remember the most about that was, I mean, like I said, back then I was young and in the neighborhoods, kids and all, we'd all go and we'd hang out and we'd have fights, you know, throw mandarins at each other and we'd get fussed for that. And then also the other thing I remember about it the most was he'd fertilize them to make them produce. And then there was that thick, the St. Augustine grass, and with the fertilizer, it would get so thick, it would grow so fast under those trees where the fertilizer was. So we had to go in there and cut that with a push mower to get under the tree. And it was a job.
I bet.
I mean, good thing my dad had six sons to do it.
Y'all had your part of the property,
didn't you? Oh, yeah. I mean, we'd cut between the rows with a riding mower, but underneath the trees, you had to do it had to be done by a hand mower. Mm-hmm. And man, it was a job.
So you grew up working hard, too.
Yeah.
Now, if you're a 13-year-old, who knows that he wants to be a shrimper? That's what he wants to do. How do you get? I mean, what do you do? Did you learn everything about how to do it from your father?
I guess that was like a starting point. You know, I learned about it, and then when I got out of school, I went immediately to doing it because I knew that's what I wanted to do. And you know, back then the industry was the fleet of the industry was a lot larger than it is today. It has been dwindling. But it was so easy to get on a boat. You know, my brother had a boat, several of my brothers had boats, and a lot of their friends and men I knew. And I was able to get on one and started out as deckhand, and I worked deckhand for many, many, many years. And then I just, you know, as you get older, and it's kind of like, to be a fisherman, either you have it or you don't. Either you like it, you love it, and you know that's what you want to do, or you just, if you go out and you try it, you'll hate it. One or the two. And I knew I loved it, and I just, you know.
Is it a certain type of person that loves it versus hates it?
It's hard to say that. I guess, yes, in a way, it is a person that loves out to be, you know, out in the water, out, it's peaceful, and, you know, just like those surroundings. Mm-hmm. As far as versus someone that, you know, so likes to be around people all the time and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said you started as a deckhand for many years. Can you tell me what a deckhand does?
The deckhand, basically, he handles the catch. His duties are versus the captain, which is his job is to catch the shrimp, keep the boat in working order. And the deckhand, he just tends to the catch and cleans the boat and, you know, icing the catch. Yes.
And does deckhand make okay money, or is that a...
It depending on the skills and the ability of the captain, how much shrimp he can catch. Cause
so the deckhand makes depending on the catch?
Yes.
You're not paid for your time?
You're paid on a percentage of the catch after all expenses.
So it would be, you'd want an angle to get on the right boat?
Yes, with a good captain. A good boat in working condition with good gear, good nets, good machinery, and a captain. A captain is basically his, everyone looks at his ability to catch shrimp. Any fishery, shrimp, crab, fish, whatever it is, you know, it's on his ability to do it.
I'm interested in how you, there must be some competition to get on the good boat and to figure out.
In a way, yes, it is. Yeah.
So is that just based on your reputation? You get a good name for being a good deckhand?
Right, and it travels around. Because, you know, it's kind of somewhat of a close-knit in each community, you know, where it gets around. And this guy, he's good. You know, you want him. He'll do the work. He's not slow. You know, he doesn't drag his feet.
So who were some of the first captains you worked for?
My dad, the first captain that I think his name was Dale Blanchard, and it was a small boat. We had only one net, and I was probably 16 years old, and he was not a good captain. He didn't care about anything. He didn't catch a whole lot of shrimp, but it was a starting point, you know.
Now, was he a relative of yours?
No, distant. Very distant relative, yes.
But this wasn't, you know, your uncle?
No. It was just a friend.
Okay. So as soon as you graduated from high school, you started doing this?
Yeah. Well, I did not graduate. I dropped out of high school in 10th grade.
Okay.
Yes. And then I immediately went shrimping because I knew that's what I wanted to do. My mom and dad, they took that very hard. I guess I was somewhat of a rebellious kid in school, you know. But I remember my dad said, "You going to work, son?" And I said, "That's exactly what I want to do," you know. And I've been doing it since.
Yeah. So how long, when did you move out of your parents' house?
Not till I got married, at 19.
Yeah. So you were, and how long were you deckhand?
Well, I would say from 16 till 23, 24, somewhere like that. And in between that, I would captain on my brother's boat. On and off, you know, I never stayed on the same boat. You'd stay for a while, but anyway. And then at times, my brother wouldn't come. I remember the first time that I had the opportunity to captain a boat, he said, "Okay, go find you a deckhand and go shrimping. Go trawling is what we call it, go trawling." Well, I looked at him like, what? And I wasn't married. I was probably only 18 years old, maybe. I was probably 17 years old. And he tells me, he said, "Find your deckhand and go trawling." And I looked at him like, what? He said, "Find somebody and y'all go trawling." It's okay. So, I mean, that was the first opportunity I had to captain on a shrimp boat.
That's a pretty big responsibility for 17.
Yeah, and that's why I looked at him like, what? What's the matter with you? Yeah. And, you know, I guess you could say a captain, older guys, they'll see if the person has what it takes to catch shrimp, you know, be able to go around the waters and navigate. I guess he's seen that in me at an early age, and he gave me the opportunity. And it was just, you know, one or two trips, we call it trips. We go out, and on that boat, we'd probably stay out 5, 6, 7 days at a time and come in. And he wasn't all the time, you know. When it was good, he was on the boat. When the shrimping was good, he was on the boat. When it would slow down, well.
Nice guy.
Yeah, he would send me out.
Do you remember that very first time you captained?
Yes, I do.
Did you catch well? Or?
Yes, we did. Yes. And he was very impressed.
Mm-hmm. And did you get to keep a larger percentage of that money then?
A little, yeah. Yeah, and when you get promoted up to captain, yeah, you do get a little bit more to share.
So just because you're captain doesn't mean you own your own boat?
No. Not at all.
So someone who owns a boat will hire you, or
ask yes, you? We'll hire you as captain.
And the owner gets it. Is the owner gets a percentage also, and the captain gets a percentage?
Yeah. Well, for the most part, the way it's operated, as far as dividing the catch, mm-hmm. All expenses come off the top. So, I mean, between your ice and fuel and groceries and oil and whatever supplies it takes to make the individual trip, it's taken off the top before anyone makes a penny. So, say I go out, back then expenses were very low. So, say I'd go out there for $3,000. Most of the time it was probably a lot less than that. But just say $1,000. If I came in with $1,020 worth of shrimp, no one made anything. Mm-hmm. If I came in with $800 of the shrimp, the owner was $200 in debt, and that would be added on to the next time you headed out. If there was a $200 balance.
Let's say you come back with $5,000 for the shrimp.
Okay, then at $1,000 expense with $5,000 net catch, you would subtract that first $1,000 and then the balance, the $4,000. Mm-hmm. Normally how that would be split would be $2,000, half would go to the boat. The boat owner, usually it's for the upkeep and maintenance and repair on the boat. So the boat owner would get $2,000, which is 50%, and then the other 50% would be divided among the crew. So if it was just two guys on the boat, which normally back then that's how I worked, I would get $1,000 and he would get $1,000, or I'd get a little more than $1,000, being I was captain.
Okay. So you said you were deckhand till you were around 23?
Yeah, roughly. I've done it on and off, even up to 25, you know, and I had captain a little bit in between that.
But then you started always being a captain?
Yes, yeah.
And did you always work for the same boat?
No, not really. I'd work for a year or two on one certain boat, and then, you know, you'd get a better opportunity and you'd move on.
So did you always think that you wanted your own boat?
Yes, and it took a long time. A long, long time for me to get it. Because I remember I tried several times, but the banks was so reluctant to loan the money unless you had a certain amount of down payment and blah, blah, blah. So I never did qualify, I guess you would say. And then I was given an opportunity when I was 20, oh, I'd say about 27 or 28 years old. I was given an opportunity to work on a bigger boat, bigger than anyone I had ever captained on before. And the owner of that boat he made a deal that I couldn't refuse. I would work the boat 1 year at normal share, captain's share. And then after that 1 year, the agreement was after 1 year that we would go 50-50, like we were partnership in the boat. But there was nothing for me on the paperwork or nothing. It was just his word, and he honored it. And I worked that boat for 8 years, 7 years, and then he had a brand new boat built, and the deal was the same. And I worked the boat maybe 3 years till it was paid for what it cost to build that boat, and then after that, I paid it back again on his, you know, our share, 50-50, and then after that, it was my boat. Just signed over the papers to me. So I had... Basically, I ended up with a very good shrimp boat at somewhat of an early age, risk-free.
Why did he do that for you?
He's just a good man. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you tell me about the boat, how big it was?
Yes, it was 63 foot. I have a picture somewhere. It's
the name of it is the Waymaker. The Waymaker.
And it's 63 foot long.
That's at the Blessing of the Queen.
Yes. And it was built in 1996. We had all the steel work painting, all the steel work, sandblasting and painting done at a shipyard. And then we took the boat from there, and we had carpenters come in to do the cabin work, the woodwork inside the cabin. And basically, I've done everything else. And it doesn't sound like much, but it's a lot of work.
Well, tell me some of the other work you got to do.
The engine, put the engine in, and I wasn't that familiar on how to do it. So the owner, he came in. We put the engine in the boat, and when it came time to line it up, which is very important, very critical, he came there and he did that, and he helped line it up. And then the rest, me and the crew basically did the rest ourselves, which is a lot of work. I mean, it's so many details, little things that just takes time to do. And it took, I think the boat was started like in late January. It hit the water in mid-April from the shipyard, and we started, and in the May we was going fishing. So it's a lot of work in a short amount of time.
How did you pick the name?
Actually, it's sort of biblical name. Mm-hmm. Like Jesus is the truth, the way, and the life. And he's the way. He's our way maker. That's where the name Waymaker comes from.
That's a good name. Now, do you remember the first time you took it out of shrimping?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do. The first time I headed out, we actually went shrimp off of Grand Isle, which is probably 40, 50 miles from our home port. And we ended up with a good catch on the first trip.
Now, can you tell me what makes that a good boat, if you were trying to explain to somebody?
It's in good condition. It's seaworthy. It's kind of an all-around boat. You can work somewhat inland. Mm-hmm. And the area where we normally fish is right along the coastline, mm-hmm. out to 10 miles or so, just roughly. Or you can go even out further out and, you know, way out, 20, 50 miles out. But we normally don't go out there.
Mm-hmm. Is there a name for, is it a certain bay? You said you fish
inland?
Lakes?
Inland?
Yeah.
No, not really. Just the inland lakes along the coastline.
Okay.
And mostly in our area, in, off of Louisiana in the middle, central part of the state.
Are there other people who are always sort of in the same spot as you?
What do you mean?
When you're out in the boat for a week at a time, are there other boats that are...
Oh, yeah. We kind of, like I said earlier, we kind of hang around in little gangs, you know, our friends. And I mean, because, you know, you work in any line of work, you have friends and you know everyone that's working with. And the same thing with shrimping. And in bayou communities, you know, everybody knows, pretty much knows each other that's doing the same line of work. And yeah, we do hang out and we, you know, we trade info. And if we're catching good and other guy's not catching good, we say, hey, man, why don't you head on over here? It's catching pretty good here. And so they'll come over.
That's nice of you.
Yeah, well, it's just, you know, the way we do it.
Uh-huh. I want to ask you a little bit more about what it's like. How long will you go out on this boat? You go out for a week?
That boat, I would say, average is 10 days. Mm-hmm. Average. You know, sometime a little less, sometime 12 to 14. And it's, yeah.
And it's you and two deckhands?
Two guys, yeah. On this boat, I have two deckhands.
What's it like being on a boat with just the three of you for 10 days
at a time? It's interesting. But, I mean, like I said, you get used to it. And the key is to get somebody you get along well with. And they do their work, they do their job. And you can rely on them to get what needs to be done to get done. And then same way they rely on me, on the captain, to catch shrimp. So they'll have a check when they come in.
How much are you actively working when you're out? Like how much of the day are you...
That varies depending on the season, time of the year, and how the shrimp are catching. If we're catching good, you could, you know, you may spend, I've seen some days probably spend 12, 15 hours working. Nah, versus sometimes I've seen where the catch was terrible, so we wasn't hardly working at all, but we weren't working, making any money. And it's basically, if you're working hard, it means you're making money. If you're not working, well, 90% of the time, that means you're not making any money.
So you're in a bad mood if you're not working.
Well, not really, because, you know, you get your bad days, and over time, over the years, you realize, you know, it's not good every day. So you take the bad with the good. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, it always averages out.
Now, can you tell me a little bit more about the actual work? Like, you drop these nets, you get just... If you were going to give me a crash course on how to catch shrimp on your boat, and that might be a terrible question, but...
Well, it's hard to explain to make someone who never done it understand.
I respect that it took you 20 years to learn to do it.
Yeah, and it does take time. You know, it's just someone that has never done it. You go out there or say, I'm going shrimp, I'm going to buy me a boat. And they'll just go out there and lose everything they have. But basically, I mean, at certain times of the year, certain areas are known to have shrimp. No, and then there's many other factors with that weather, the winds, the seas, the currents. Sometimes it's day, sometimes it's night. So, I mean, and all it just comes by experience. So I would say, like, if you go and there's an area that has shrimp, so you go, you put your nets down. Sometimes you pull it for a couple of hours before you pick them up. Sometimes maybe 4 or 5. And then you empty them out, and then you got to cull them out. You got to clean up, separate the fish from the shrimp. And once that's done, you can ice them up. And then once it's iced up, it's rest time. Everyone gets a break until the next time to pick up the nets and start. And basically, is you put them down, you pick them up an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, whatever the time is, they go right back down.
Because when they're up, you're not catching.
Right. They go down if it's good enough. If it's not good enough, well, you leave them up and you move places. Mm-hmm. Try to find a better area.
What do you do with all the bycatch?
They go back over into the Gulf.
Okay. You just toss them.
Yeah. Toss them back.
What is a great day? How many shrimp will you catch in a great day?
Well, that also varies. Some on the size, the value. Mm-hmm. If they're smaller shrimp, they value less. If they're bigger shrimp, the value is more. It's an average day. It's hard to say. It used to be if you would gross $1,000 worth of shrimp in a day, you was doing good. It was worth fishing on. Even a little less, you know. And then since 02, 03, when the prices on shrimp fell down because of imports, well, it went up, I would say, $1,500 per day. Was a good day.
Mm-hmm. And about how many pounds? I know it depends on the size.
It depends on the size. 1,000 pounds, depending, you know, on average, I would say 1,000 pounds a day.
Mm-hmm. And what do you... you're pulling these nets up, and then is it mechanical how they get dumped up? They get dumped on the deck?
Yeah, it's all done on the winch on the boat. Mm-hmm. And through a rope and pulley system. Mm-hmm. You know, pulley situated in the right position with ropes run through it. It brings the equipment where it needs to be so you can do certain tasks.
And then what the deck nets are doing is they're pulling, separating the shrimp from the fish?
Yes.
Throwing the fish back?
Right.
Okay. And so that all gets done, and then you said there's rest time. So what do you... So there are quarters on the boat to sleep?
Yeah, we have quarters, kitchen. I mean, a normal galley, you know, kitchen, laboratory. And, you know, get something to eat, just go sit down in the AC and rest.
You eat a lot of shrimp on the boat? Or?
Not as much as one would think. We do, but not every day. You know, maybe some days once a trip. Some trips, I remember, we don't eat any. But sometimes we'll eat more, you know, it just varies.
Can you tell me about, going back to the work a little bit, has that changed over time? The way that you do it?
The gear has changed. The gear has got more efficient over the years. But the basic work, the way it's done, is, for the most part, is the same, for the most part.
If your father came out in your boat, he'd know more or less what to do?
Well, it wouldn't take him long to catch on because my boat is different than what he had. He had a small boat that put on only one net. This boat here... it's called a double rigger, where it has the tall outriggers, and when you're in port, they're up in the air, but when you head on out to the Gulf, they go down, and they stay down the whole time, and they're held in place by stay cables, mm-hmm. Guide wires. And then we pull a net off each side, mm-hmm. double rigger. My father's boat, it was a single rigger, and we pull one net off the stern. And this one here, I pull one net off of each outrigger. Well, in my case, now we went to what we're calling four riggers, where we pull two nets off of each side. And they're smaller nets, see, versus a double rigger to a full rigger. If you're a double rigger, you'll have, say, 250-foot nets, one on each side. So if you're a full rigger, generally you'll go to 225-foot nets on each side, which is the same netting,
right?
But... A four rigger net tends to work more efficiently.
Okay, and is that what most people are doing out here?
For this category, the size boat, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, in the Louisiana shrimp fishery, there's so many different user groups, meaning so many different size boats. You have some that's much larger than this, and then you have some that's much smaller, mm-hmm. all the way on down the line. So, and then they all do different. fish different areas, have different gear.
So different kind of gear, you're going to go to a different part of the
world. Right, right.
Okay. Are your nets made locally?
I make my nets myself.
You make your nets yourself?
Yes. I buy the material and I cut them out and sew them together and myself.
That must be a special skill to know how to do too.
Yeah, it took a long time for me to do that, to learn how to do
that.
Watching some older fellas when I was, younger, and just getting info, and I just picked it up over time. I mean, it's like anything, you do something long enough or you see it long enough, you're going to pick it up.
How long does a net last?
Excuse me?
How long will a net last you?
I would say average 3 to 5 years, mm-hmm. if it doesn't get damaged by bottom obstructions.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sadie was telling me about the turtle exclusion devices. She said that was an issue.
Yeah, it was an issue. And I think way back in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, was a big issue, and we eventually ended up having to use them. And at the time, we wasn't seeing any turtles because, it was something that was basically shoved down our throat by the government, and I mean, we abided by it for the most part overall, and we're still using them today.
Still not seeing a lot of turtles, though?
Nope. And the area that we normally fish, there was never known to have a lot of turtles. I mean, I've seen some, don't get me wrong, I've seen some, but not nowhere near the amount that they claim.
Now, does it hurt your catch, or is it just an expensive device to buy?
It's an expensive device, and it does hurt our catch at times. Mm-hmm. There is a loss, yes.
Are there other, how subject to, government rules and regulations are you with your?
We're at their mercy.
Tell me about that.
Over the years, they've come up with so many regulations, and we really have no choice but to abide by them. Or the fines are just, it's tremendous.
Can you give me an example of a regulation that, just seems silly? I get the sense from how you're saying it that you think some of these are don't do any good.
I'd rather not talk about that.
That's fine. Okay. Yeah. Well, let me ask you differently. I asked you if... it's changed over the years, and you said it's pretty much the same.
Yeah.
The style of work hasn't changed that much.
Yeah, the general technique hasn't changed. It changed some from different types of gear,
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, everything is, like, as far as hauling in and emptying the catch and laying back out, it's basically all done in the same procedure.
What about the rest time on the boat? I'm imagining with the cell phones and all that, you mentioned that before. Has that changed what it's like when you're not working on the boat?
A little. Yeah, you got better communication with your family when you're not, versus way back before there were cell phones, Sometimes you wouldn't know what's going on up at home until you got back in. Mm-hmm. And now you could be in contact with them daily or all day long, every day, if you're in a cell coverage area.
Does that mess with your sense of solitude when you're out there?
No, not really.
Okay.
No. It's just good to know what's up with, with your family when you're out.
I'm sure.
Yes.
Now, switching gears a little bit, you told me that when you were in Chauvin, you saw a bunch of storms and flooding down there. And can you tell me about, do you remember Betsy? Was that?
No, I remember vaguely. I was a kid, mm-hmm. but really, that was way before my time.
Yeah. What were the big storms that you remember that sort of made you want to get out of there?
Hurricane Juan, 1985. I remember my son was 2 years old. It was on his birthday, and we was coming back from Audubon Zoo. Mm-hmm. And on the way home, halfway home, I turned on listened to the radio, and then it came on and said there was a hurricane in the Gulf, and it was there was a depression in the Gulf, and it's like bam, it developed all of a sudden. And that storm, it wasn't a major storm. I think the top winds was 90. But what happened, it came from the southwestern Gulf, and it came over Louisiana in our area, and it turned and went back in the Gulf. And then it came back, it hit us twice. And the flooding down there was, it was crazy. And I had a mobile home, and I was fortunate. I had just lifted it up on... It was on regular piers that a mobile home comes on when you buy it. Well, I had lifted it up to 36-inch house blocks. And the water just came to the bottom of the floor. So I didn't have no major damage. I had a little change insulation under and stuff like that.
You didn't have your boat yet, but we're
alone. No, I didn't have a boat yet at that time. I was deckhand on, I think I was deckhand on my brother's boat at that time.
That's one of the risks, I guess, you assume when you own your own boat, when these storms come in?
Yeah, to bring it to safe harbor, secure it down. Mm-hmm. This is basically all you can do.
Where do you bring your boat?
I bring it into Chauvin, further, as far up as I can at my brother's house. And basically all we do is we secure it down with 30 or 40 different lines with different slacks, you know, that way to allow for the high tide to come up, because, and pray for the best.
Mm-hmm. You had your boat for Katrina, that?
Yes. Earlier. Yeah, but yes, I did.
How did it do?
It did well. Katrina didn't affect this area that much.
Okay.
Yes.
Did, Rita was okay here too, all
right? Right. We did get flooded for both, but the winds weren't very strong.
Okay. So the flood is less of a concern for the boat because you tie it down.
It goes up
and
up, yeah.
Okay. So what was the last straw with leaving Chauvin?
Well, we had been wanting to move out of there. You know, our kids were young, mm-hmm. and we had been wanting to, and it took several years for us to save enough money to get a little down payment, and then another year to find something that we liked and we could afford. Mm-hmm. And so we did it.
Is there a big difference between living down there and up here?
Not really. I'm not near my boat. Whereas when I was down there, living down there, I had the boat on the, right there. I'd walk out and I just, and if anything I wanted to fix, it was there. I'd just go out and do it if I felt like it. Whereas here, I'm 45 minutes away, so you just, you know.
More time in the car.
More time traveling back and forth, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to ask about that. How many of your other, you have one other brother who's a shrimper? Or?
Two does it full time.
Okay, and they live right around here?
They live down in Chauvin.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you work with them? Do you go out in the same spots with them?
From time to time. We have they have smaller boats than I do, so a lot of time we don't fish in the same area. In fact, rarely do we. Most of the time we are fishing different areas than they do.
Are they jealous of your big boat?
No. No, not really.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you, I'm thinking about this oil spill, but I want to ask you maybe, before I ask you about the disaster that happened, did you have thoughts about the oil industry before all this? Do you have family that works offshore or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. I'm not one that's anti-oil. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's needed. Despite what you hear, there's nothing that's been proven to be effective, you know, alternative source of energy. So, I mean, they can say what they want, but we need the oil.
One of the things that really strikes me, being from Connecticut but spending a lot of time down here, is that people back home say to me, anyone who works in the water must hate the oil industry. But in fact, I find that it's the opposite.
It is the opposite.
That there's a real close relationship between people who are...
Right. Unless you're close to the industry, the oil industry, and you know it's... you see its daily operation, I mean, or... maybe you get a better understanding of its importance because it does support a lot of industries. It's probably the biggest industry here in South Louisiana. And it's a lot of related businesses almost everywhere you go. And it's all dependent on oil.
Could you take a rough guess at around here in Houma or back in Chauvin, how many people are working as sort of fishermen or shrimpers and how many are working in the oil industry? Is it about equal or are there a lot more in oil?
As there's probably more in oil. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there probably always was.
Yeah.
Well, maybe back in the 70s when and 80s when shrimping was probably at its highest point as far as the fleet size. Mm-hmm. Maybe then there may have been a little more or maybe equal.
Mm-hmm. How big is the fleet now, by the way? Do you
think that's... Oh. I'm maybe on the whole Gulf Coast. I'm saying maybe 2,500 to 3,500 boats.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can we stop for a little while?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that could lead into the effects of it, what I think, you know.
Yeah, great. Okay.
Because, you know.
Okay, so why don't we just took a little break and you were telling me that sometimes you'd be on the boat thinking about the oil industry.
Yes, I can remember over the years just out there imagining one day we're going to have a major spill, and what, you know, what it would look like and what the effects would be. And being working on this all cleanup for going on 3 months now, it was nothing like I imagined. I can remember imagining just solid black oil on the coastline everywhere. And my concern was always from the loop port, the Louisiana offshore oil port, which is off of Port Fouchon off the coast of Louisiana, I guess roughly 60, 80 miles. And it's where the big tankers come in, and then they pump oil into the storage. And I was always thinking it would be one of those tankers, mm-hmm. or a pipeline would rupture. And come to find out, it was nothing like that. It was from an actual well. Mm-hmm. And then being working on this cleanup, it was nothing like I could remember imagining, as far as the amount of oil that we've seen. Now, bear in mind that the work that we're doing, we're assigned certain areas near coastline, out to 12, 15 miles, sometimes 20. And we're assigned to protect that area if oil comes in. We was never allowed to go way out to the spill site itself. So most days, probably 2/3 of the days that we've been out there, we have not seen any oil. And the days that we have seen oil and we worked on it and we caught it, we absorbed it, we did a good job on it, I think.
Now, are you out in your boat, or are you out in someone
else's? No, I'm out on my boat, yes. And my boat is still out there today. I have a captain on it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
When did you have to stop trawling?
I had actually stopped in the beginning of March to do my yearly maintenance. And then that usually takes 4 to 6 weeks to do. And then we usually head back out. Well, that was, then here come the spill on April the 20th. And I wasn't quite done yet. And no one knew at the time exactly how long this was gonna last. Little did we know it was gonna go on till nearly 3 months. And then we got called up to see if we wanted to go clean up on the oil. And we knew the shrimping, that at that time there were certain areas that was close to shrimping, so we knew we couldn't go and rely on certain areas that are known to hold shrimp would stay open for us to go and shrimp like we normally would. So yeah, we just go ahead and get this for now to see how things turn out.
So how much have you been going out for BP, for the cleanup? How long have you been, you go out?
Since May 1st. We actually left on May 2nd, and my boat has never came into the dock but twice in nearly 2.5, almost 3 months.
And have you been out on the water most
Yes.
of the time?
I was out for the first 3 weeks. I came in for 2, then I went back out for 4 weeks, and it's going on 3 weeks I'm in now. And the boat has been out the whole time.
But you go out for a month without coming back in yourself?
I've done once, and that was the longest I've ever stayed on the water. It was too long.
What's the spirit like out there during the cleanup?
Well, we're divided up into what they are calling task force, which is a group of 25 boats. And in our certain task force, we're all friends. We know each other. We've shrimped with each other for years, so we all get along great. And the mentality is, let's catch this. And this is kind of like a little joke between in the groups. Well, we can't catch shrimp, so let's catch oil. There's only one other thing we can catch right now. It's oil, so let's just do it. And that's kind of the mentality. And I mean, they're eager. They want to get it. The days that we run around, ride around and looking for oil and we don't find it, and it's kind of like, you know, a little upsetting because, you know, we can't make a difference. We can't help out.
Do you feel like the cleanup effort is being, how do you feel like that's being managed?
Well, it's got its ups and downs. I think there's too many chiefs, so to speak. It's got to go up the chain of command, and it's got to come back down the chain of command. Like, for certain things, one guy can't make that decision. He has to go and ask him, and then he has, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think they're having a supply as far as the absorbent materials. They're having a problem supplying the adequate amount for the whole coastline. You don't hear much about it, but, you know, being out there and working a little bit behind the scenes, I've seen it.
Who should be in charge of it?
The oil industry. I don't think the government should be involved. Because, I mean, sure, they did create the mess, but who's better knowledgeable to handle it and deal with it and shut it off than the industry? Because you're not going to go get a car salesman to come remodel your kitchen cabinets, right?
That's true. So do you feel like, you were saying before that you know all kinds of people that work in the oil industry and it's good for South Louisiana, the oil industry. Has this spill changed at all, those feelings?
No, not really. It's a terrible accident, and it sounds like there is some fault to blame. There were mistakes made, and hopefully out of this, that'll be corrected. And that's what government does best, probably. I don't know about best, but... and, I mean, everyone knows over the years, the industry has gotten away with a lot of things that should have been done differently. And my personal feeling is it's not just the oil industry. I think it goes back to politicians that made these regulations or let this slide back way back in the days, you know. Like all these pipelines that's cut through our coastline, that's got a lot to do with our coastal erosion. And that should have been done something different. Sure, the oil industry was paying them out of their pockets, the lobbyists, through lobbyists. But still, I mean, that's, you know, our local politicians on the state and government level, I mean, their part to blame too, I think.
Do you think that the spill is going to have political effects? Like, is it going to change who people vote for down here? Anything like that?
Well, I never really thought about that. So I would think yes, in a way, yes.
Mm-hmm. What about, so you think the cleanup effort is going about as well as it could?
Yeah, for the most part. Like I said earlier, we've been out there for nearly probably 80 days, 75 days so far. And 2/3 of that was days that we never seen any oil, wasn't able to work.
Do you feel like you're being treated fairly in terms of them renting your boat and paying your time?
Yeah, for the most part. There was a few issues, but they're getting worked out.
So in general, you feel like?
In general, yeah.
Okay. And you know, you hear some stories about people's health out there. Have you had any?
Well, like I said earlier, we've been out. We was the first task force to get assigned to go out and do this. So we've been out there the longest. And from what I've heard, we have been the task force that has been on oil the most. And we've seen all the dispersants. We've seen all the different forms the oil gets through natural evaporation or the effects of dispersant. And for the most part, any of our guys has gotten any sick from it. They have gotten sick from dehydration. I think that's the main thing that I've seen anyway, is dehydration. Now, as far as long term, come find me in 15 years, you know.
But so far, you feel pretty good.
Yeah, I do.
Great.
And, you know, we've had air monitor guys come out there. You know, I think they've been provided by OSHA, and they've been doing testing. And the readings they come up with all seem to be safe.
If you had to predict into the future, this time next year, do you think it would be shrimping again?
Well, that is probably my main concern. Because there's no way of knowing what the long-term effects of this is going to be. If this is over in 6 months and we're released, or hopefully it even goes that long. But anyway, we don't know what we're going to do. If there's going to be shrimp, if this area is going to be open to shrimp, because there's so much oil below the surface, where it's going to go. I mean, there's just so many unanswered questions. What the effect the dispersant is going to have on the shrimp larvae for the next crop. So it's going to be interesting to see how this pans out in the next year, 2 years, up to 5-10 years, you know. It's just, no one knows.
Is that the big topic of conversation among everybody?
Yes, it is. I did read an article last night about the second largest spill, before this one was down in the Gulf, Bay of Campeche, and near the Yucatan, there was a spill that lasted 9 months, and it ended up spilling less than this one. I'm not sure exactly, not that much less. And it sounds as though it took a year or two for the shrimp fishery to come back, but I don't know to what, if it was like before or not. So we'll see. We don't know. It's just too much uncertainty going on right now.
Are there ways that you see people, you know, dealing with the uncertainty?
No. Everybody's pretty much taking in stride, you know, day by day. And for the most part, most fishermen are just thankful right now that we have, you know, the BP hired us to clean this up. And we're also thankful that it was a large company that was able to dole out the amount of cash they have been doling out. Because if this had been a small operator, things would be totally different along this coastline right now. I mean, there's the so-called super fund that's been set up. You may know something about that. Now, how much that is and how long that would have lasted, I don't know. But, you know, for the most part, people are just glad. I guess, I don't know, glad is the right term, but you know, that it was a large company, a large operator.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but that's true. They could put up $20 billion to...
I mean, if that had been some small operator, that, you know, what would happen? And then I know there's that super fund that all the different oil companies, they pay taxes and whatever into it for situations like this. But how large is that fund? And then you would have had the government managing it from the beginning. And from the beginning, BP has paid up for the most part. You know, they was poking out some money in it to the people that was directly affected. You know, that when you come to the fishermen, the charter fishermen, the you know, that we're the ones who was directly affected at the very beginning. And they stepped up to the plate for the most part. I mean, there were some problems, don't get me wrong, but so.
Do you, you know, here we are July 20th, and we've just capped the well, we think. And so this is sort of a time capsule, you know, because we don't know how it's going to turn out. I wonder... if there's something that's on your mind now, just in terms of thinking about the future, not knowing how it's going to turn out, that you want to put down in terms of your hopes or fears or just thoughts about what should happen?
Well, why this spill happened was in deep water, and deep water is fairly new. You know, it's not a whole, hopefully they'll learn a lot from this. Because, I mean, you're talking a mile of water between the rig and the ocean floor, whether, and It has been done before, but there was, I think personally, there was probably a lot of uncertainties exactly with certain procedures. And it sounded like there was some mistakes made. Definitely, it sounds like that. So hopefully nothing like that will happen in the future. They'll get a handle on this, and they'll be more effective in the future when nothing like this happens again. And, I mean, it was an accident. And what is an accident? I mean, everything's fine 1 second, and then bam, something happens, no matter what it is. If you're in an auto accident, or, you know, you trip on the, walking in the yard, you break your leg, you wasn't expecting that. But, so hopefully in the future, they'll get a handle on this deep water exploration.
We've talked a little bit about, you know, floods and hurricanes, oil spills, all this stuff. I think people who haven't been here might want to ask you why you bother staying. Do you have an answer to that?
It's home. It's what I like to do. It's what I chose to do. I mean, I'm a commercial fisherman. I didn't get forced into it. It's what I wanted to do from a young age, and I knew it, and I like it. And you just deal with the elements. Whether you live in California, you got to deal with earthquakes, which you have no warning, or in the plains where you have tornadoes. I mean, in here in the coast, we have hurricanes. We get days warning. That's what I chose to do, and I love it.
Is there anything you've learned from some of those challenges, like hurricanes or anything, that is coming into play now that's helping you or helping people on the coast deal with this, or are they too different?
You say it again?
I'm asking about, you've been through all these other challenges, floods and hurricanes, and I want to know if there's anything that people have learned from those earlier challenges that they're applying to this one, or if hurricanes and oil spills are just too different to...
I guess, I don't know, they couldn't say they're related, but I mean, I think it maybe I've taught people endurance and have patience, and you can get through it, through things. You can work them out, you know. I think that probably has maybe come out of it.
Mm-hmm. So you have hope and faith for this part of the country looking forward?
Yeah, I do. After kind of hearing a little bit what happened in different oil spills around the world, eventually things, you know, revive up. I am optimistic.
That's good. Is there anything else you'd like to add? I think I'm bad out of questions, but.
I guess that's about it, man.
Yeah?
Okay. Yeah.